Los Angeles, California. This is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Monday, November 9th, 2015. President Obama rejects the Keystone XL pipeline in a massive victory for climate justice activists. We'll speak with Daphne Wysham. And Chicago area cop's killing has been ruled a suicide. Journalist Sean King will explain why people are outraged. Plus, author and academic Sarah Deer will discuss her new book, The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. That's coming up after the news. President Obama is hosting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today in what is sure to be a meeting filled with tension. It is the first time that the two heads of state are meeting after the U.S. signed the Iran nuclear deal that Obama has touted as a central part of his foreign policy legacy. Obama and Netanyahu had butted heads over the deal, with the Israeli leader openly criticizing his appeasement of Iran. The meeting comes just days after presidential candidate and former Obama cabinet member Hillary Clinton wrote what many characterized as a love letter to Israel. Late last week, Clinton published an op-ed entitled "How I Would Reaffirm Unbreakable Bond with Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu." In it, she said, quote, "For me, fighting for Israel isn't just about policy. It's a personal commitment to the friendship between our peoples and our vision for peace and security." In other international news, Myanmar just held its first democratic elections in more than five decades. Sunday's elections are another step toward the opening up of the nation after years of dictatorship under a military junta. Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, who has only been freed from her house arrest for a few years, is confident that her party will win the elections by a landslide. In unofficial results announced this morning, her party declared a 70% win in big cities like Yangon. But in areas where minority groups are dominant, her win was less secure. While she is championed as a human rights activist, Ms. Aung San Suu Kyi has remained relatively quiet on massive government abuses of ethnic minorities like the Rohingya, who claim that there is a program of genocide being waged against them. In domestic news, walkouts are happening at the University of Missouri this morning, after a weekend of tensions between students and university administration. At least 30 African-American football players at Missouri declared over the weekend that they would not play until the university president resigns. Black student groups have long been complaining of discrimination and racism on the mostly white campus. The black athletes joined a growing sit-in on Sunday. They issued a statement that read in part, "The athletes of color on the University of Missouri football team truly believe injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We will no longer participate in any football-related activities until President Tim Wolf resigns or is removed due to his negligence toward marginalized students experienced. We are united," end of quote. University President Tim Wolf was confronted in October by black students blocking his car during a homecoming parade. On tomorrow's Uprising, we'll turn to Christina Mislan from the University of Missouri for more. In other news, presidential candidate Donald Trump's appearance on Saturday Night Live this weekend irked a good many people. The racist candidate's appearance generated a massive ratings for NBC. Trump followed up on his appearance with four interviews on Sunday talk shows. The free publicity that his campaign received was likely worth far more than what he could buy in political advertising. In the lead-up to his appearance, the Latino advocacy group Presente.org launched a campaign calling on NBC to drop Trump and hire regularly featured Latino actors instead. In a petition, Presente said, quote, "Donald Trump's rhetoric is not only offensive and racist, it is dangerous and has already led to violence against Latinos several times. By allowing Trump to host Saturday Night Live, you are validating this inflammatory rhetoric as acceptable mainstream discourse." Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders' campaign also seems to have a problem with Latino voters. In a campaign stop in Las Vegas, Nevada, Sunday night, Sanders' campaign pulled out all the stops, hiring a mariachi band at a rally in a soccer field. The problem was that the attendees were mostly white. According to the Guardian newspaper, quote, "Latinos largely shunned the call to, quote, feel the burn, leaving the crowd to dance stiffly to the Mexican music," and a question mark over the campaign's prospects in Nevada. And finally, as we head into the thick of shopping season with Black Friday rapidly approaching, the group Fight for 15 is holding a series of nationwide rallies tomorrow, that's November 10th. Fast food workers, who have been a critical part of the campaign to organize for $15 an hour in minimum wages, will be walking out in cities across the country. Organizers hope it will be the biggest ever nationwide strike. More information is at fightfor15.org. This is Uprising. In a minute, we'll return to regular programming, but I want to take a minute to just tell you a big, big thank you to all of the listeners of Uprising with Sonali who donated so generously to KPFK on Mondays and Tuesdays at 8 a.m. during our recent fund drive. I'm totally overwhelmed by your support, your solidarity, and your generosity. And we are returning now to regular programming. That is non-fund drive programming for the next 3 weeks. The next fund drive will begin on December 1st. After this short break, we will turn to the UN climate conference in Paris and what is leading up to that, which is a huge victory. And that is the defeat of the Keystone XL pipeline project. Then activist and journalist Sean King will join us to discuss the bizarre story of a police lieutenant Joe Glinowitz in Fox Lake, whose killing was actually a staged suicide. And finally, Sarah Deer will join us to discuss her new book, The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. This is Uprising, back in a minute. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. After 7 years of deliberation, studies, reviews, and activism, the story of the Keystone XL pipeline project seems to have come to a close. President Obama announced on Friday that he was rejecting the Trans-Canada project. Just weeks before a make-or-break UN climate conference in Paris, Obama said, quote, America is now a global leader when it comes to taking serious action to fight climate change. And frankly, approving this project would have undercut that global leadership. Climate justice activists who have fought long and hard are celebrating the end of the proposal for an 1,100-mile-long pipeline that would have cut across the United States, transporting 800,000 barrels of tar sands oil a day. The victory comes just over a month after Shell Oil pulled its project of offshore oil exploration in the Arctic. Joining me now is Daphne Wysham. She's the director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy, and she joined us to discuss the Shell Oil victory. Welcome back to the program, Daphne.
Thank you for having me.
And here again is another victory. How thrilled are you and others?
Well, we're enormously thrilled, but this is just the beginning of the end of new fossil fuel infrastructure. It's clearly a turning point, a watershed point in our movement, but what we're calling for now in our next step is no new fossil fuel infrastructure, starting in Portland, Oregon, and moving up and down the West Coast, and hopefully on the East Coast, and all around the world. This is the beginning of an effort to essentially turn the tide at the very last minute against temperatures rising that threaten human civilization, and we have no time to lose.
I'm really glad to hear that activists like yourself are taking the offensive and basically not resting on your laurels because time is running out. But let's, for a minute at least, focus on what you think led up to Obama's decision. I mean, for years, this seemed like this project was likely to pass. There's been a lot of support from the administration and the incredible civil disobedience over many years seem to have had some impact, but not necessarily much impact. But now it seems as though it did have an impact that we weren't seeing. How much do you attribute his decision to the civil disobedience, the activism, et cetera?
Oh, I think it was 100% about civil disobedience, activism, 40,000 people surrounding the White House in 2013, 400,000 people marching in the streets of New York City for climate justice. Of course, we now have also reached a point where there is greater public acceptance of the climate science. It's becoming clearer and clearer every day, and certainly you're feeling the brunt of the climate impact on drought in California and extreme weather events. It's becoming clearer and clearer just how serious this crisis is, but it started in the tar sands of Alberta with Native with First Nations folks, and all along the pipeline, Native Americans were resisting this pipeline, ranchers, others came together really across divisions and essentially worked as a coalition, a huge coalition across this country with one voice standing together saying, we will not allow this pipeline to proceed. And Friday, we won.
What role did activists in Nebraska play as well? This was a state through which the pipeline would have cut, and it became a sort of epicenter of the fight.
That's right. There was a major decision yet to be made in Nebraska by one of the judges there around whether or not this pipeline could proceed. And it's possible that the judge would have ruled against the pipeline had it continued through the courts. So that was preempted by President Obama's decision.
Now, the Keystone XL pipeline project was built around using an extremely dirty fuel, which is tar sands, an extremely inefficient fuel as well. So how important was this fight to kill this project, given that many other fuels are still in place? We still have the use of dirty fuels like coal, although coal plants have been under stricter regulations. Should we be seeing this as one piece of a bigger puzzle?
Yeah, I mean, what is happening in the background, of course, is that the price of oil and gas has plummeted as a result of all of the fracking that is happening in this country. Excuse me. And as a result, tar sands, which is some of the most energy intensive and expensive forms of fossil fuel to extract from the soil, where you literally have to heat up the soil and in order to turn it into a liquid and then add all sorts of chemicals and other substances to allow it to flow in a pipeline. It is one of the most difficult fossil fuels to extract. It's what people call one of the many forms of extreme energy that we are now beginning to extract as the easily accessible forms of energy become depleted. So simultaneous to the fracking that's going on in the U.S., the price of oil and gas has dropped dramatically, and tar sands suddenly becomes less economically competitive. And it's one reason, the cynics could say, well, it's going to come back in another form as soon as the price of oil rises. But, I think what the climate movement is beginning to do is it's flexing its muscle and it's saying, no, we actually have come to a point where we are going to see stranded assets, where investments in fossil fuel infrastructure will no longer make sense, and investors should pay attention.
Now, the TransCanada, which is a company that had been spearheading this campaign for the Keystone XL pipeline proposal, on November 2nd, asked the Obama administration, so a week ago, asked Obama to suspend its review of the project, which led many to believe that maybe this was its way of avoiding getting a rejection, because they saw that the rejection might be coming. It also also would have given Obama an out if he wanted to just sit on the sidelines and drag this project on and dump it into the lap of the next president. The fact that he actually took a position, and I want to repeat his quote. He said, America is now a global leader when it comes to taking serious action to fight climate change. Well, that's arguable. But he said this project would have undercut that global leadership. Those are strong words.
Yeah, they are strong words. And I'm just going to move away from my phone call. You know, several things have been happening in the background here. Of course, Trudeau became prime minister in Canada, and that changed the politics completely in Canada.
He was supportive of that.
He was supportive. And who knows how much of that was, you know, his way of deferring to some of his supporters in running for office, and how much of that was sincere. But clearly, the politics have shifted in Canada. So that was one thing that has changed. And the other thing that is all about the timing is we're just weeks away from the major climate summit in Paris. And so Obama is fighting an uphill battle with everyone from, you know, China, who apparently is not counting their greenhouse gas emissions accurately. The African delegation is threatening to walk out because they aren't getting enough funding on the table to address adaptation and mitigation to climate change. There's a whole host of other issues that are playing out. And this was one sort of ace that Obama could play prior to the Paris climate negotiations that shows he is, in fact, responsive to social movements and responsive to calls for greater action on climate change.
Yeah, it's a very, very important time, and timing is crucial for this project. Let's talk briefly about what the stakes are in Paris. The Keystone XL pipeline is one project. It was a project that, if it had gone through, would have significantly impacted the amount of emissions that we're facing, but it was a project that actually never realized. We have climate change now. So many are calling the Paris conference a make or break conference. What do you think? What's at stake?
Well, I've been to enough of these international climate negotiations to know that there's always all of this expectation that somehow our world leaders are going to save us from the climate catastrophe. And the fact of the matter is that it is up to all of us. It's up to social movements on the ground to push them much further than the governments will ever agree to go to. There's a lot of brinksmanship. There's a lot of waiting until the last minute to play a very weak hand. And we know from the commitments that are on the table right now that the commitments from all of the different countries that have submitted their cuts in emissions, that we aren't even close to 2 degrees Celsius, which is exceedingly dangerous. The scientific community actually is suggesting we need to get closer to 1 degree Celsius or 1.5, but not 2. And the commitments on the table get us closer to 4 degrees Celsius. So we've got a long way to go. And it's one reason why groups such as the groups that I'm working with in Portland and up in Seattle have been essentially taking matters into their own hands and saying no new fossil fuel infrastructure. We are drawing a line. If we need to keep 80% of proven fossil reserves in the ground, we need to stop acting as though business as usual can continue. We need to stop building the infrastructure, because once you do that, the projects will move forward and these fossil fuels, including coal, will be exported and burned very cheaply, and we're going to stand in the way of this new fossil fuel infrastructure, just as we did in the way of the Fenica and Shell, and we're going to say no more. So that's the battle that I see being fought on the West Coast of the United States in coming weeks, and I think you'll be hearing a lot more about that.
And in general, finally, how important is activism from the United States, given the leader that we've been in pushing for extraction of fuels and use of fuels? I want to mention, actually, today there's about 1,000 young activists that are reportedly marching in D.C. that are linking up things like racial justice, immigration, and climate justice reform under this banner that they're calling Our Generation, Our Choice. It includes members from 350.org, as well as the Fossil Fuel Student Divestment Network, Working Families, and Million Hoodies, linking these issues together. And it seems as though when you have issues of climate justice joining up or being put into the same category of importance as racial justice and immigration, then there is no stopping activism.
Absolutely. And let's make no mistake that the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline started with First Nations folks fighting for their right to survive as they're being slowly poisoned by the tar sands. And it was only, once it began to become clear just how serious the climate impact was of the tar sands that the rest of civil society got on board. So many times it is, the most immediate impacts on frontline communities that trigger a much bigger social movement, but we need to stand in solidarity with the frontline communities, and those include immigrants, because as the temperatures rise around the globe, we're going to see an awful lot of climate refugees, and we need to be treating them with the kind of compassion that we would hope to be treated with were we in their shoes. So it's very exciting that these movements are coming together, and I think we could be reaching critical mass very soon.
Absolutely. In fact, speaking of climate refugees, Oxfam just released a new study that is called Shockwaves, Managing the Impacts of Climate Change on Poverty, about how climate change is going to be impacting the most vulnerable communities among us, which is something most of us already know. Well, Daphne, I want to thank you, as always, for the work that you do and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Daphne Wysham is the director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy, talking about the Keystone XL pipeline decision. President Obama late last week announced that he was defeating it. This is Uprising. We will be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. When 52-year-old Fox Lake Police Lieutenant Joe Glinowitz was found dead of a gunshot wound to the chest in early September, the Chicago area community that he worked in mourned a man they called a hero. Glinowitz radioed in before his death, saying he was pursuing three armed suspects, two white and one black. His death prompted a massive manhunt for the supposed suspects, who never turned up. In the days that followed, pro-police voices took to the airwaves and blamed the Black Lives Matter movement for creating an environment where police were being targeted more often. Now, in a bizarre twist, Glinowitz's death has been ruled a suicide. The cop, who was known as G.I. Joe, was just months away from retirement, but was apparently involved in an embezzlement scandal, having allegedly siphoned off thousands of dollars from a youth program that he ran. He worried about being exposed when an audit of the program was imminent. Authorities now say his death was an elaborately staged suicide. My guest is Sean King. He's a well-known civil rights activist and a reporter with the New York Daily News who's been covering the story. Welcome to Uprising, Sean.
Hello, good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, when this happened, when Glinowitz, we now know, killed himself, which was in early September, what was the rhetoric that we saw coming out of Fox News, but lots of other pro-police groups as well, police unions who saw this as a huge uptick in their eyes of violence against police? Did they straight out come and blame Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, I think part of what's tragic about it is within hours of him killing himself, and he staged it to look like he had been killed, in part because it affects the way his family would receive his pension and benefits. But within hours of him being killed, people were blaming Black Lives Matter. People were asking why President Obama is waging a war on police. And this is before any investigation has taken place. And so before any facts were in, what you see is that they were already kind of abusing the situation to blame activists who had nothing to do with this whatsoever. And so when we finally find out that he was ciphering money off of a youth program, that he was actually plotting to kill somebody in his local government, and that he killed himself, it really only confirmed what we said in the beginning, like, hey, it was always wrong to blame Black Lives Matter for this. But now it just kind of blew up in their faces.
Right. He apparently texts and emails have shown that he was considering ways to kill the Fox Lake Village administrator, the woman who would have done the audit that would likely have revealed his embezzlement. And actually, Sean, I want to play for you and our listeners an excerpt of a Fox News correspondent trying to lay the blame of Glinowitz's killing at the feet of Black Lives Matter.
You know, I'll tell you, when you look at the actual numbers, now initially it may look like it's not happening as much as it did last year. It's a difference, though, and the difference real quickly is this. We have a lot of this anti-police rhetoric going on across this country right now, Martha, and that is definitely playing a role in some of these shootings. Look at this shooting just down in Texas this past week of that police officer gunned down in cold blood. You can't tell me, and you'll never be able to tell me, that that wasn't the result of some of this rhetoric that's being exposed by some of these groups like Black Lives Matter. They are calling for the lynching. They are calling for the killings of police officers. And when you have an individual that's already mentally unstable, people tend to react to that kind of crap. And what we're going to continue to see are these kinds of shootings until we hear something come out of the White House and the Justice Department clearly stating that this will not be tolerated. And we haven't heard that yet, Martha, out of anybody at the Justice Department.
And that's the kind of rhetoric we heard from Fox News and other media outlets. Now, Sean King, how much does the story of Lieutenant Glinowitz actually confirm exactly what Black Lives Matter and other civil rights groups have been saying about police abuse and police abuse of authority?
Yeah, I think it does a lot. And that's a great observation. I think it does a lot to confirm what we're saying, that he was actually the fourth officer in the past 60 days who shot himself or fabricated some type of shooting or set up some type of fictitious environment in which Black Lives Matter was blamed. But not only that, this year is on pace to be the second safest year ever in the history of America, all the way back to 1900 for American police. So far, 31 officers have been killed in America. While each of those is tragic and even this suicide is tragic, there were years in the United States where over 300 officers were killed. During the Reagan administration, on several years, almost 200 officers were shot and killed. This year, we're all the way down to 31 officers. During President Obama's administration, during these 7 years or so, it's been the safest 7 years ever on record for American police. And so it really reveals that all of this is sadly about politics. And one of the things I've been trying to tell people is that the leading cause of death for police in America is actually suicide. And more officers kill themselves, about 150 per year, than are ever shot, killed, or die of any other cause. But you don't hear any conservative leaders talking about police suicide. And sadly, this death in Fox Lake, it's another suicide in a long string of suicides in American police officers. Hmm.
Glinowitz's personnel file was released to the public. Apparently, they show that he was routinely in violation of policy. He was involved in sexual harassment claims, and yet he kept getting promoted. What does that say about how cops are treated, even within their own departments, in terms of impunity?
Yeah, it is almost impossible to fire bad police in America. And, you know, I'm covering an officer now, Bill Melendez, outside of Detroit. And he said 12 lawsuits filed against him. He was recently arrested for a brutal assault of a a grandfather named Floyd Dent. But each and every lawsuit going all the way back to the late 90s states the same thing over and over and over again, that he was brutal, that he was corrupt, that he lied, that he was racist. And now in his trial, which is going on right now outside of Detroit, even today, finally, you know, really damning evidence is coming out that things that people have been saying for 20 years about Bill Melendez are true. And the same is true in this case. And sadly, corrupt officers often go from department to department to department. They'll even move across country. And even the officer who shot and killed a 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland had been fired for just gross incompetence from his previous department. And in his personnel file, his supervisor said, emphatically, I do not think these issues will ever change for him, and he should not work in law enforcement. Cleveland hired him, and less than a year later, he killed a 12-year-old boy. And so there are lots of reforms that need to happen here. And, you know, I think we just have to chip away at these reforms bit by bit.
The other aspect to the Joe Glinowitz case in Fox Lake near Chicago is that it appears as though this man might have been a rapist. He was accused of forcing a woman to have oral sex, which sounds like rape. Yes. And he was sent to sex rehab and was suspended, but not fired. Last week, there was a detailed Associated Press report about rampant rape and sexual abuse by police around the country. Shouldn't this, too, be a big part of our current debate on police violence?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that AP report really was one of the most powerful reports detailing rape and sexual assault by police all across America in almost all 50 states. Thousands of officers over, if you go back even 20 or 30 or 40 years, but at least 1,000 officers have been fired for rape and sexual assault in the past 10 years alone. And yet somehow police are still able to keep a rather sterling reputation in the eyes of many Americans. And sexual assault is not taken seriously across the spectrum. But the idea that police abusing their power could sexually assault men and women, actually, in some cases, and get away with it is just horrific. And to me, really echoes the Catholic Church abuse scandal, where people just didn't know how to properly report them, because those who were doing the abuse were so revered across the country.
Right. I mean, if a policeman rapes you, who do you call? I mean, the other part of the problem is that police protect one another. Just as Joe Glinowitz's sordid career details didn't come to light until they were studied by authorities and revealed how, you know, we basically have this wall of silence. People refer to it as a blue wall of silence. Even the cops who aren't corrupt protect the ones who are corrupt, which taints them too.
Yeah, absolutely. And It's anybody would tell you, even good police would tell you, that it's a closed network. Police departments are fiercely loyal to one another and go to great lengths to protect each other. And there are times where they may feel like that's what keeps them strong, but in the cases of corruption and abuse, it's toxic. And I still believe that there is a way to reform policing in America, but it's gonna require a new level of oversight that doesn't put police, and this is strange, doesn't put them in charge of investigating each other. And I think what we're seeing here is that they're just not capable, and they're not able to honestly and sincerely take each other's faults seriously.
I also finally want to talk about how the media plays into protecting the sterling reputation of police. Recently, I understand you were invited by CNN's Don Lemon to discuss this very story that we're talking about, and you turned him down. I appreciate you accepting our request, by the way. Why did you turn down Don Lemon? I also understand that your Twitter account was temporarily blocked, possibly because of that.
Well, you know, a couple months ago, my story and my racial background and history was a national story in America. And I was incredibly frustrated and offended at the way Don Lemon told that story. And even though I provided so many people who've known me my entire life, who knew my story my entire life, he really chose to tell lies and spread lies that people just completely manufactured. And so I was shocked when they reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to appear on air with Don Lemon? Because respectable journalists across the country called him out on how he handled my story. And so I just wrote back a simple email just telling them, like, hey, I would never appear on air with Don Lemon, and that I probably would never appear on CNN over this because of the way they handled it. For days on end, they said this over and over and over again. And so I took a screenshot of my exchange with the producer and posted it, and didn't think twice about it. I went to get my hair cut, and while I was getting my hair cut, I tried to check my tweets and my account. I've been on Twitter since 2007. My account's never been suspended. And my account was suspended. And basically, when I tried to log into Twitter, it said, hey, if you don't delete this tweet, you can't access it. And at first, my thought was that it was just CNN, like in a power move. But when I took the screenshot, it had the producer who sent me the email, and she was never like the focus of my frustration. It was more about Don Lemon. It had some of her personal contact information in there. And I think that had more to do with it than anything else. And my intention was never to, like, if that frightened her, scared her, I regret that it caused her any heartache whatsoever. And so I don't know if nobody ever said if that was it, but I think that definitely played a part in it. And so I deleted it. But I think for me, the greater story was just the tone deaf nature of somebody in the media kind of doing a terrible treatment of someone's personal story and then pretending like it never happened. Mm-hmm. And so that's that.
Well, I didn't want to dignify that story by asking you about it point blank, but I do appreciate you bringing it up. And of course, people can read about it online and read your work. Where's the best place? Is Twitter the best place to follow your work? If you locked out of Twitter, is there another place?
If you, my name, Sean King, SHAUNKING. I'm at Twitter at Sean King, Facebook the same name, Instagram the same name, and I don't think that'll happen on Twitter again. I think for me the lesson was, even when you're frustrated, don't respond with like a knee jerk reaction, and that's some of what I did there. I was just so frustrated at how it all went down.
Well, Sean, I appreciate your analysis and your work. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Sean King is a reporter with the New York Daily News and a civil rights activist. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook. And by the way, breaking news, the University of Missouri's president, Tim Wolf, has just resigned in the face of a walkout by faculty and a strike by football players. We'll have coverage of that story on tomorrow's Uprising. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Sarah Deer joins us to discuss her new book, The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. There is an epidemic of rape in the United States. That epidemic has its epicenter in Native American communities. One third of all Native American women will be raped in their lifetimes. That shocking statistic underpins the work of my guest, Sarah Deer, who has written a new book about how rampant rape has historically been a tool of colonialism and continues to be so. Sarah Deer is a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's a 2014 MacArthur Fellow. She's the co-author of 3 books on tribal law and co-editor of Sharing Our Stories of Survival, Native Women Surviving Violence. Her new book is called The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. Welcome to Uprising, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how historically has rape been used as a tool of war, of colonialism against Native communities? And how much documentation even exists to show that violence?
Well, you know, it's not that hard to find the historical accounts. And if you go all the way back to Columbus, you know, there was a passage written in a journal by one of his shipmates talking about, you know, the minute he landed, you know, he captured a woman, a Native woman, and he brought her upon the ship and he raped her. And there was no sort of apology for that kind of behavior. There was an arrogance and assumption that the land was free for taking, the people were free for enslaving, and the women were free for raping. And so that mentality that comes with colonialism is very much intertwined with assault on women.
Now, the United States has never fully reconciled with the project of colonialism of Native American lands and people. But there have been apologies offered. And in your book, you tackle this issue of apology and, you know, just the acknowledgement on the surface level that something severe, dire, horrifically wrong happened. What do you make of this apology, and how does it work when you're talking about rape?
Well, the government, the U.S. government, has issued a couple of apologies. One came from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and one came from President Obama. You know, and there's sort of mixed feelings about apologies as a general principle. I mean, what do they really do? But, you know, when I think about it from a rape victim's perspective, just an acknowledgement of the harm that has been done can go a long way towards validating a survivor's experience. The problem I see with the apologies that have been issued is they don't confront the issue of sexual violence. They apologize for land removal, for the Trail of Tears, for boarding schools, you know, a lot of the horrific things that Native people have experienced. But somehow rape is not on that list. And it's interesting because murder is, you know, homicide and Indian killing is, but somehow, even though rape is a lesser serious crime than murder, we still don't talk about it. And I think that just demonstrates the shame that people have with even the word, talking about rape as a concept.
Right. You, in your book, make a note about using the word rape rather than sexual assault or sexual violence or sexual abuse and these kind of clinical terms that have become substitutes for the word rape. Why is language so important?
Well, I think, you know, the terms sexual assault and sexual abuse are certainly valid labels for crimes in a contemporary criminal justice system. But, you know, the crime is really not about sex. And so I choose to use the word rape when possible to make sure that people understand it's a political issue. And it's not just a clinical harm that happens.
So let's talk about law, actually, because that's really important when we talk about rape and sexual violence in Native American communities, because of the nature, the pretty complex nature of legal boundaries when it comes to Native American communities and tribes. How has the law been, in a way, used to undermine the claims of women who are raped?
Well, frankly, just as a short answer to that is the legal system is broken, so it can't address, you know, the harms that are happening. But the real issue is around the taking of jurisdiction away from tribes, taking the power away from tribes to make decisions about their own community and to take action when harm comes to the community. You know, that's, again, sort of a metaphor for how rape victims experience the crime. Control is taken away. You don't have the right to decide what happens with your body and your soul. And so when the tribes were confronted with this loss of jurisdiction, it feels helpless. It feels like, well, if something happens, you know, in our community, there's not very much that we can do to stop it. And so that's why the legal system is has a huge role to play in why Native women experience such a high rate of sexual assault and rape.
So let's talk about the extent of rape in Native American communities today. One might argue, the project of colonialism is over, and that you don't have white men going and raping Native American women anymore. How do you characterize what is happening today? Why are the numbers so high?
Well, I think that without a system to hold people accountable, it's very, very difficult to stop rape. You need victims to come forward, although I hate to put that burden on any individual victim, but if you're going to stop rape, you need victims to come forward, and then you need some sort of legal accountability for that person. And if that's not happening, the message to both victims and perpetrators is, nothing will be done, and I can either get away with this or I will suffer and nobody will respond. And so the numbers are sky high. Without accountability, you simply can't begin to address the crisis.
And so does the issue of rape become part, however, of a complex of social problems facing the communities that are linked to lack of sovereignty and poverty, et cetera?
Absolutely. I mean, so Native people experience the highest rates of PTSD in the nation, four times as high PTSD. And what causes that PTSD? Well, very often, child abuse and sexual violence are the triggers for developing the post-traumatic stress disorder. And post-traumatic stress disorder leads to all kinds of ills. It leads to mental illness. It can lead to physical illness. It can lead to addiction. And so if we're really honest about some of our social issues in Indian country, we have to address rape, because it's sort of the foundation of many of the challenges that we experience as Native people.
How much of it also has to do with how Native American people are viewed by non-Native communities, by the majority dominant communities here in the United States? People just, we just passed the annual Halloween tradition, and it's often a popular idea, sadly still popular idea, for people to dress up in tribal gear, wearing headdresses and feathers. And does that also play into the fetishization of Native women?
I think absolutely it does. And the dehumanization of Native women is really central to being able to attack them, right? If you don't see Native people as human, then, they're just a character. They don't have humanity. It's much easier to attack them. I think the more dangerous thing besides the really offensive use of headdresses and feathers is the Pocahontas kind of syndrome that we're seeing, where Native costumes for women are very sexy. They have very short skirts and they're very temptuous. And that really plays into the sexualized, racialized view of Native women. And the other issue, frankly, is that we are invisible. So, if the only time you see an Indian image is on a sexy costume, then that's what you think of Native people. So the invisibility and the marginalization of our communities also plays a big role.
Is there a difference between the epidemic of rape here in the United States and also our response to it with Canada? First Nations communities in Canada have been very active on drawing attention to rape, but also killings and disappearances of Native women there, of First Nations women there. Is there a comparison, or is it more of a continuum?
I think that there's definitely a comparison. I think the history of Canada's treatment of Native people and the history of the United States treatment of Native people are very similar. There's a lot of overlap in terms of the policies and the destruction that occurred. Now in the United States, I haven't seen as much attention paid to missing and disappeared and murdered women. But I do believe, just on my own research, that we have a very similar problem in the United States, where we have hundreds of missing Native women that are not being looked for. And I just don't think we have put the same level of attention to it that the activists in Canada have.
Now, let's going back to the issue of law and how that has worked against Native women. We'd had you on our program to discuss the Violence Against Women Act, which is something that Congress has struggled for years to deal with, how to treat Native American women in that act. And you write about that in your book as well. What is the current status of the Violence Against Women Act and how Native women are treated in that act?
Sure. Well, it was signed in 2013. And what it did, in addition to a lot of pieces for, you know, a lot of different groups of people, the Native specific sections of VAWA did change one aspect of jurisdiction that will, in the long run, help tribes do a better job of protecting their women. But that jurisdiction restoration only applies to crimes of domestic violence. So it only applies when your victim and your perpetrator have a relationship or a former relationship. And in that case, if a non-Indian commits that crime against an Indian woman, then he can be held accountable in tribal court. So it's a very tiny sliver of the change that is needed. And so rape is not included in that. If you were raped by an acquaintance or a neighbor or a stranger or a doctor or a police officer, and you're not in a relationship with that person, the tribe still lacks the authority to take action if the perpetrator is non-Indian.
And so is there a lot of work that needs to be done on the issue on within the realm of tribal law to address this?
Absolutely. And this is our biggest challenge, right? Because we have been able to go to Congress and make them understand that the jurisdiction has to be restored. It should have never been taken in the first place. But now that the jurisdiction has been restored in certain cases, now we have to make decisions as tribal nations. We have to decide, how are we going to exercise this restored authority? Are we going to implement the same kinds of systems that we see at the state level? We know that those systems aren't particularly victim-centered. So are we going to replicate those, or are we going to think outside of that and come up with some systems that are fair to defendants, but do a better job of making sure that victims don't fall through the cracks?
Isn't there a patchwork of tribal courts around the country? How would you, start to see reform happening on a nationwide level?
Well, it's difficult because there are over 566 federally recognized tribes, and each one of those is going to have a very different approach. What I do think will be helpful is, as tribes are able to think about new ways of addressing rape, they can certainly share their journeys with other tribes. But what works for one tribe might not work for another. And that's why in the book I advocate, each individual community coming together and having these difficult discussions and coming up with something that's going to work for their community.
And so how also can people and the federal government, I should say, facilitate that process? Because, of course, it's important to preserve the limited sovereignty that tribal nations have within the United States. But on the other hand, as we've said earlier, rape is part of a complex of social ills that are, that are part of a historical and current legacy.
Yeah. So the laws that are in place, they really facilitate rape because they don't hold people accountable. So we need more federal reform.
And what do you mean by they don't hold people accountable? Aren't rapists able to be prosecuted and tried?
They absolutely are on a technical level, but it's just not happening. We just don't see the numbers of rapists to be fair, they're very difficult cases to prosecute. Right. And that's because of the Anglo-American system that really, puts the victim on trial instead of the perpetrator. What was she doing that night? What was she wearing that night? Right? Those things are still happening. But what the federal government, in my mind, the obligation of the federal government is a trust responsibility and, in many cases, treaty obligations, to make sure that tribal nations are safe and that they can govern themselves. So if the federal government is serious about addressing rape, then they will restore jurisdiction and they will provide resources for infrastructure so that tribes do have the resources to take these cases on their own terms.
Finally, what role has President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama played in addressing such issues in Native communities? They've certainly been more interactive with tribal communities than other presidents have been. They've tackled the issue of youth unemployment, of poverty, of education within these communities. Have they also taken on the issue of rape and sexual violence?
I would say yes. I mean, President Obama was, in his administration, I should say, was very much in support of these changes to the Violence Against Women Act. And it was a quite disturbing time period where the Republican powers were very much opposed to restoring jurisdiction and were willing to tank the Violence Against Women Act as a whole just over this question, which tells you that they're very scared for some reason of tribal jurisdiction. But the administration held firm with the support of the advocates and grassroots communities, and said no. This is something that Obama wants to leave as his legacy, is to help tribes return to being vibrant and safe places to be.
Sarah, we talked about women victims of rape. What about children?
Well, we certainly have a high rate of child sexual abuse. It's a little bit harder to study that population because, when we're studying adults, they can consent to sharing information and sharing it anonymously. But when you have children and you're trying to study them, that becomes very challenging. Can a child consent to an interview about being victimized? And then do the researchers not have an ethical obligation to report child abuse? So we just don't have the same kinds of numbers, but we can extrapolate from what we know. And one of the most disturbing pieces of data that has come out of the look at Native children is that Native children, on the whole, experience the same rates of PTSD as soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's wow. The same level. Mm-hmm.
And so finally, let's also talk about the issue of how we changed popular culture and how we changed the issue of invisibility, which you mentioned earlier, and stop relying on these reductive stereotypes that show up during times like Halloween, and I should say what's coming up, which is Thanksgiving.
Sure. Well, the dealing with invisibility is hard because it's very rare for an Indian topic to, be picked up by the mainstream media or to be picked up in prime time. And so it's often, radio outlets and progressive news agencies that cover these issues. But we really need to push the issues up mm-hmm. to the level of broad awareness, because I think, most of the time when I talk about this issue to non-Native audiences, people come up to me with tears in their eyes. Yeah. I feel so guilty. I didn't know. I'd never heard of this. Why didn't I hear of this? And, I can't blame somebody for not hearing something that was never presented to them. Mm.
Well, your book, I'm sure, goes a long way towards changing those attitudes. Sarah Deer, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Deer is a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. Her book is called The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and audio engineer. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Find us on facebook.com/uprisingradio and twitter.com/uprisingradio. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you tomorrow.